Welcome, everybody. I'd like to call this meeting to order. Can I get a roll call?
Mrs. Avalos?
Here.
Mr. Davis?
Here.
Mrs. DeGracias is not yet here. Mrs. Hickey?
She's here.
Here. Mr. Moore?
Here.
Dr. Thompson?
Here.
Ms. Williams?
Okay, and our second order of business is to recognize visitors and invite comments from the public.
There's no one that signed in on the speaker roster, but they may have signed in on the attendance roster by mistake. So if anyone is wishing to speak, now's the time.
Or throughout the meeting, this is actually a town hall forum, but if somebody would like to take their official 30 minutes at the beginning of the meeting, you can do so now, or you can wait, and we're gonna have a conversation about social emotional. Okay, next order of business. I need a motion to approve the agenda.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Okay, the microphones on your table are working, so you might, if you want to.
Are working?
Yeah. Yes.
What?
Welcome, everyone.
Nope. I guess there's a button that makes it work.
Oh, okay. Good evening.
Do we have a tech director in the house?
It's working, except for the business.
Who's the other on?
No?
There we go.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Committee of the Whole meeting that is dedicated to a presentation by our Education Committee, chaired by Nicole Thompson, and Social Emotional Learning in District 9.
Yeah, you can just go.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming. I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Hall. I think we're all going to. I think we're all going to move out there.
See you later.
Do we need to see?
They want to see.
Okay.
I got a whole hand.
Well, thank you, everybody, for being here. We appreciate you coming, especially with a lot going on this week. I'm sure there are a lot of different events in District 90, especially the conference is starting, so we really do appreciate you taking the time. I am Dr. Allison Holly. I am the Director of Curriculum Instruction here in District 90. I would also like to introduce Susanna Cleese and Allie Capewis. They're going to co-present with me this evening. They are social workers at the elementary school, and they have a lot of information they can share that's building-based. We have the second half of the presentation. So with that, I will just get started. Okay. So this evening we're here to talk about the importance of social emotional learning. Here in District 90, we do a lot of talking about responsible academic risk taking in order to support our students to put themselves out there, to be creative and innovative, try new ideas and strategies. It's essential that we create a school climate that intentionally fosters a learning environment that makes it safe for them to do exactly that. Social emotional learning is about creating a climate that supports a growth mindset, values mistakes within the learning community. Students must feel safe and supported in order to embrace messiness of learning without fear of judgment or negative consequences or reprisal. It really is a mindset that's opening to learning through mistakes. That's where the growth occurs. The World Economic Forum. According to the World Economic Forum, the top 10 skills are comprised of both academic and social emotional learning skills that are needed for students to navigate the workplace and their future. The ability to manage people, coordinate with others, possess emotional intelligence, have negotiation skills, and being able to take a service orientation towards people and communities. SEL skills carry equal weight with academic skills. It's important for our schools to develop both. So what does research say about SEL? The research highlights that academic success is inextricably linked with healthy social and emotional development. They work together as opposed to parallel with one another. Learning is also about collaboration. Collaboration with others and not solely individual endeavor. This understanding of how students learn has been woven into the fabric of our learning standards and incorporated into instructional materials. Research shows that peer-to-peer collaboration enhances student engagement, builds community within classrooms, and makes strategic learning visible for all students. In the same way that academic skills such as writing have clear learning progressions that build over time, the development of SEL skills follows a similar pathway. Foundational skills acquired at an early age act as building blocks for more complex skills that emerge later. We know from brain research that brain imaging that stress and anxiety has negative effects on learning. Studies show that cortisol, which is a stress-induced hormone produced in the brain, can interfere with memory. It can impair concentration, motivation, and produces feelings of intense anxiety. The brain can be stressed by something that seems as small as a time test, but it can also be due to traumatic events or ongoing trauma that a child experiences. The social-emotional state of your child matters. Abraham Maslow, an American psychologist, developed a hierarchy of needs. Maslow illustrates the needs that are lower on the pyramid must be first met in order to access the next level of development. Students must feel psychologically supported in order to feel safe. They need to feel safe in order to have a sense of belonging. That sense of belonging also leads to feelings of acceptance and a hierarchy. This model recognizes the layers of social-emotional safety that need to be attended to. And it's important for schools to be responsive to all students, but especially to those students whose needs, for whatever reason, are not being met within or outside of the school. So what is social-emotional learning? What are its components? The Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, also known as CASEL, outlines the skill sets that SEL is intended to develop. On the outside of the graphic are concentric circles you see for homes and community, which incorporates family and community partnerships, schools that involve school-wise practices and policies, and classrooms that facilitate social-emotional curriculum and instruction. At the center are the five core competencies: self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision-making. To look at it in a more detailed format, CASEL breaks these core competencies down further into overarching skills and themes. I don't know how hard it is to read in the back, so I'll just name a couple. When you're looking at self-awareness, you're beginning with identifying emotions, recognizing strengths. Self-management involves impulse control, self-motivation, goal setting. Social awareness is about empathy, respect for others. Relationship skills involves social engagements, relationship building, being part of a team. And responsible decision making is about analyzing situations, evaluating ethical responsibility. And as these skills build, you can see that they get more sophisticated over time. The state of Illinois has adopted CASEL's five core competencies and developed SEL standards for kindergarten through 12th grade. These reflect the five cores, but in addition to that, they have three goals that they focus on. Goal one is related to self-management skills to achieve in school and life. Goal two is really about establishing and maintaining positive relationships, and three, around decision making, is responsible behaviors in personal, school, and community context. So, given that this is the framework, they've also developed learning performance descriptors organized by stages that outline concrete skills for students to develop over time. This chart illustrates goal two, which is using social awareness and interpersonal skills to establish and maintain positive relationships. This progression recognizes that mastery will not occur at the same point in time for all students. So as you see at the very bottom of the slide, kids at different grades are often in multiple stages at any given time. And again, these skills develop by stage, starting with something as simple as recognizing that others may interpret the same situation than you differently, or paraphrasing something that someone said. So this is an example of a K-5 progression. This is an example of a K-6 progression. And again, you can see the skills get more sophisticated. Practicing effective listening, recognizing the importance of setting limits for yourself and others. That's a very sophisticated skill. I think adults still struggle with that skill at times, certainly setting boundaries and managing our own work and stress loads, work-life balance. We talk about that a lot. So then how does all of this relate to social-emotional curriculum instruction practices? Some SEL skills are taught explicitly through board meetings or explicit SEL curriculum, or even through advisory, which our social work team will talk more about in depth as we continue. But in addition to that, over the last few years, District 90 curriculum committees have also worked to evaluate and pilot instructional materials, specifically math, writing, and reading, that in addition to providing rigorous content, also incorporates social-emotional learning opportunities. So for example, student collaboration is often embedded in our reading, math, and writing materials. Opportunities to persevere in problem solving, expectations for giving and receiving feedback, valuing different perspectives, and understanding that not everybody solves problems in the same way, and making that variability in learning visible for everybody to see. Now, it's important to note that in addition to the clearly articulated social-emotional learning standards by the state of Illinois, there is overlap with other standards. So the standards for mathematical practices deal with mathematical behaviors, and there is a lot of overlap between those standards and also ELA standards, where you're looking at perspective taking and interpreting verbal and nonverbal cues, different things like that. So they're not mutually exclusive. There is some overlap, but some are better explicitly taught in some content areas or settings than others. But ultimately, they are reinforcing one another, whether they are applying their social-emotional skills they've learned discreetly through a program like Second Step, and then applying those skills to the academic work that they're doing with their classmates. So with that, I'm going to hand this off to Ms. Cables. She is our social worker at Lincoln.
Good evening. I am one of the social workers at Willard with Ms. McLeese. We're both there, and I'm there for time. Thank you for your time. So social-emotional learning intervention supports. You may have heard of RTI, which is response to intervention, or PBIS, positive behavior intervention supports. And out of this grew a new framework, which is called multi-tiered systems of support, or MTSS. MTSS is designed to address both academic and non-academic challenges, including social, emotional, and behavioral ones. This approach allows schools and teachers to consider the whole student. Students struggle in different areas, and providing support in just one area, such as in an academic subject, could completely overlook other groups of students who, say, struggle with forming social connections or regulating their emotions. These social-emotional skill deficits directly affect those students' availability to learn and ultimately their academic performance. Thus, MTSS helps schools provide needs-driven strategies and interventions so students can perform their best. Supports are delivered at three tiers that increase in intensity and are based on initial data collection as well as ongoing progress monitoring. This data not only drives the content delivered at the tiers, but also determines what additional supports a student may benefit from or those that they may no longer need. As you can see here, tier one is the largest tier and establishes a foundation. It's considered to be core instruction and basic interventions delivered universally. It generally supports 75 to 100% of students. Tier two is considered supplemental. Students that need additional support on top of tier one in order to be successful are purposely targeted. This generally supports 10 to 25% of students. Tier three is considered intensive and often individualized. Generally, less than 10% of students receive interventions at this tier, only after not responding to tiers one and two. Students don't receive tiers in isolation, but as layered support. A student receiving Tier 3 also receives Tiers 1 and 2 or has received those prior. This lends to inclusion versus exclusion. Students aren't removed from tiers as their needs increase. Removing supports for students who may need more would be counterintuitive. The tiers are flexible in that the intervention considered to be a Tier 1 support at one school may actually be a Tier 2 support at a different school. That's because schools have different sets of students with different needs. For example, an SEL curriculum like Second Step may be provided to all students at one school as a Tier 1 intervention, or at the other school, maybe it's a Tier 2 intervention that's provided in small groups by the social worker. Tiers also evolve. So as supports take hold and interventions prove to be effective, students may find that, or schools can decide that an intervention that maybe was really effective at Tier 2, hey, maybe we want to move forward and move this to Tier 1 so all students benefit from this great curriculum that we found. So I'm going to dive into the tiers a little bit more specifically here. Tier 1 instruction and supports are proactive and preventative. The goal is to create an environment where all students and faculty are not only prepared for, but also supported ongoing when it comes to social emotional learning and behavior management. The aim is to hopefully prevent and reduce challenges in these areas. Tier 1 often establishes the school culture given its content and broad reach. For example, in D9D, we have the Willard Way and Lincoln Pride. These are school-wide mantras that outline what's expected of students and faculty in the school community as a whole. Other Tier 1 examples are programs and curriculums that involve all students and all staff, such as Roosevelt's advisory program, a social-emotional curriculum being taught in all classrooms, such as Second Step, which was mentioned earlier, town hall, class meetings, or professional development for teachers around how to integrate SEL into their academic instruction. Tier 1 also includes supports that are made available to all students and staff, even if they're not accessed by all of them. For example, school clubs like Kindly Wizards or Mindfulness Club for students, or building committees for staff. And the students and faculty that make up Tier 1 can also be more specific than the entire student body. For example, let's say fourth graders have a mini series of lessons in the spring about social situations they may encounter in middle school. Since this doesn't really apply to other grade levels, fourth graders are not being targeted per se. So in this case, the Tier 1 is all fourth graders. Tier 2 includes supplemental instruction and supports. These don't replace Tier 1, but rather align with it and reinforce the messaging. The goal of Tier 2 is to target students with a specific area of need and then provide them with the necessary skill sets for them to be successful when they return to only receiving Tier 1. For example, in one school, there may be a handful of classrooms in the building where behavior is becoming fairly challenging. The Tier 1 supports do not seem to be meeting the level of need effectively. So perhaps in addition to Second Step being taught by the classroom teachers in those classrooms, the social worker partners with those classroom teachers and comes up with a more customized SEL lesson and goes in and teaches those. So in that example, Tier 1 is all students in the school, and then Tier 2 includes the students and teachers in those handful of classrooms. Another Tier 2 example, let's say there's an entire grade level that's struggling with peer conflict. Small group counseling through lunch bunches could be provided to some of the students within that grade level, during which they talk about conflict resolution or social skills taught and practiced while they're eating lunch. In this example, Tier 1 would be the entire grade level, and then the students in those groups would be considered Tier 2. I do want to note that although Tier 2 involves a smaller group of students and teachers than Tier 1, and at any given time, over time, Tier 2 may touch a larger portion of a student and faculty due to varying needs over time. So for example, a student may be in a lunch group while in second grade for anxiety, and then a year plus later in third grade, they receive a classroom intervention around friendship skills that was a Tier 2 based on that classroom's need at that time. So they're both Tier 2 at different times. Tier 3 instruction supports are more intensive. Generally, they're targeting an area of need that has persisted despite a student receiving interventions at Tiers 1 and 2. And by the time this tier is reached, only a small number of teachers are involved and a small number of students. For example, maybe a student is struggling with managing their emotions effectively, despite having had advisory at Tier 1 and a lunch group at Tier 2. So a Tier 3 support might include individual counseling with a social worker, or a check-in and check-out program with another faculty member, or a referral for mental health support in the community, or all of the above. Other Tier 3 supports include systems and processes that are put in place that support students when their needs have exceeded other tiers. For example, a functional behavioral assessment is a collaborative process where staff identify antecedents of behavior, and then that data is used to drive a behavior support plan to support that student in school. Another example is D90's Crisis Intervention Protocol, which incorporates Crisis Prevention Institute's nonviolent response to manage and prevent at-risk or unsafe situations. And similarly, the behavior threat assessment team at the district level will be developing protocol for responding to threats that may arise.
Good evening to everyone. I'm Suzanne McLeese, and I'm the social worker at Willard, and I'm so lucky to have this year to have Ali Capeless be working with me. My job tonight is to, or my role is to really share our wonderful community partnerships and how important community connections are to really developing and growing social emotional health and in our children. And as I was preparing for this, I was kept on thinking about the African proverb, that it really takes a village to raise a child and to create an environment that is both safe and healthy. And so to really meet those Maslow's needs, the hierarchy of needs, we really need all of you to do that. And in addition, learning doesn't stop outside of the classroom. It continues out into the community, and different partnerships and organizations really help us sustain and support and to really grow our children's social and emotional skills. So I'm starting with the Roosevelt Advisory, which I think just the advisory itself is a really prime example of community connections, because the advisory, the idea of one, was held for many, many years, but it really didn't come into place without the support of the Inclusivity Advisory Board, which is a board made up of administrators in District 90, staff of District 90, and community members. And it was through a survey that really highlighted that not enough children really felt a connection to an adult. So the advisory was put into place. The advisory has two big events. It meets weekly, but it has two main events, one in the fall and in the spring. And the past two falls, they've had organizations come. It's a day event where they have presentations by these different organizations and also activities for them. Last year fall was encouraging service by all these wonderful organizations. And then this fall it was supporting inclusion. And one of the wonderful things about these relationships too is that it also provides, has been access for us for professional development. Like Lurie's Children's Hospital just recently gave a presentation in an afternoon for staff on gender issues and gender identity. Best Buddies is here, but it's also at the elementary school at Willard. So there's a lot of kind of weaving in and out of these opportunities for children. I'm a people person and not a thing, so let's see. I did it, yay. This is really, we can't do anything without parent organization and partnerships. And these are just a few examples. One thing I meant to say early on is that my lists are not exhaustive. As someone who did community mental health, for many, many years before coming from the school. I know how rich these two communities, Oak Park, River Forest, are for services and opportunities for our children. So these are just an example. The Kindly Wizards really is there to kind of help children learn about kindness and service. The Mindfulness Club is with is an outshoot of Connect for Kids, where we're really teaching children from first grade through fourth how to really be present and focused and to manage their feelings. HeartWorks is at Lincoln. Girls on the Run is at both schools, really empowering young ladies. And then Hero Boys Run Club for boys. And then I know our community partnerships. This is a very short list of things that we can do. I have really enjoyed a relationship with interventionists from the Oak Park Township Service as well as the Youth Network, which I know that other people in the audience are members and contribute to. Community support service has been a wonderful support for families who have children with special needs. AMIDI, it provides some really concrete services for our children, like eyeglasses, so they can see. And I really want to give a shout out to Carla Sloan, who's been really a wonderful partner, and really sharing whatever resources there are, and help to really develop a SIP Shop program in connection with Thrive in Oak Park. And that is it's a program that helps the SIPs, the siblings of children with special needs. Then our local community mental health centers, and then the West Suburban Recreation Association. Connect for Kids is an organization, I don't know the total history. I think it started at Lincoln, a group of parents who really wanted to support and to really the social emotional needs of children and not to have that overlooked or have that really highlighted. It's grown to be through the district, and there's it's a whole Lincoln and Willard program now, and they have brought in some great speakers for all of us and really trying to promote and help us sustain a mindful learning community. And thank you. Turning it back over to Dr. Holly.
Thank you. Just to expand a little bit on Connect for Kids, in addition to what Suzanne was sharing, was they provided a lot of programming and support for our schools over the years, and they really focused on expanding their offerings to kids, not only during the day, bringing in speakers, but also extracurricular opportunities that have been very impactful, and we are very appreciative of all of our community organizations in the PTO, because truly, if you look at the original graphic where it looked at home and communities and schools and families, it really does take all of us to support our students. There are a couple opportunities that we can still look at when we look at District 90, as we are beginning to expand our understanding, not only through brain research, but just looking more deeply into student anxiety and why there might be raising incidences of social work caseloads. Kids have needs, and we're learning more and more about trauma-informed care, and that students do come to us that have had traumatic experiences. It could be something like a divorce, it could be a death in the family, it could also be some sort of ongoing trauma that they are living with all the time. And it's important for us to recognize that that's a reality that students are living with, and that when they carry that with them, it makes it very difficult for them to feel psychologically supported, to feel safe, in order to be an active participant in learning communities. So when we think about next steps for District 90 and things that we could look into more deeply, trauma-informed care is one of those. There are three pillars to trauma-informed care. One is creating a sense of safety for that individual child, making deeper connections with that child, building that relationship to help them manage their emotions. The whole idea or belief system around trauma-informed care is every misbehavior, every instance of acting out is related to a need that isn't being met, and it's really important to understand what is that need that isn't being met that is triggering the behavior? Because if you can understand and identify the need, you can help address it with the child. The intervention is not so much an explicit curriculum as it is a it's a relational solutions that you help a child communicate how they're feeling, helping them identify their trigger points, and being able to provide them with strategies to intervene so they can manage themselves more productively. Another opportunity here in River Forest is looking more closely at restorative justice and restorative justice practices. While this may occur in pockets in different classrooms across the district, it's not systemic, hasn't been systemically implemented. But this is another way to get at problem solving. It also contributes to school climates and culture. And it's really about maintaining healthy relationships. And when you get into school environments, kids disagree. Middle school is a really particularly difficult time for a lot of kids in terms of negotiating who they are in the world and who they are within the group that they're in or the group that they're not in. And having an opportunity to allow individuals or small groups of people to come together to really discuss, confront issues, and productively resolve them. It really is about acknowledging and repairing harm that does occur. So these are two things that we are people are beginning to build their knowledge base around. We do have some people that are going out to learn more, so we can think about what the next steps might be in regards to trauma-informed care and restorative justice. With that, we are at the question and answer portion of the evening. So we can take questions.
So I guess I want to start just by saying thank you for coming out tonight and our social workers giving this presentation. Thank you, Dr. Holly. And of course, you know, we will take questions. I think my first comment is just the list of social emotional learning and interventions that we just have seen. Each one of those you could discuss for hours, and there's lots of research behind every one of those interventions. So in 40 minutes, we basically saw an abstract of what's happening here in District 90. And with the rise of anxiety and reports of the rise of anxiety and trauma with our students and research, showing how we can, as a school, can build systems of support to mitigate, you know, the negative effects of trauma and stress and anxiety. It's really important to know that our district is really working hard at implementing those. And I think most people that I speak to say we need to do more. So we're constantly looking for more research, more interventions, other models to incorporate into our already pretty robust system. The other side of that is I do hear in the community some people say, well, we never needed this when I was a child. And so I guess we'll start with, it is a mandate, social emotional learning standards, and it is a mandate to incorporate by the Illinois State Board of Education, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the 2003 Children's Mental Health Act made that a mandate here in Illinois, thankfully, from my opinion. So you have the kind of pendulum from both sides, but we here in District 90 want to make sure that we do the best in terms of incorporating those learning standards. So again, are there any questions from the audience?
Hi,
I'm
Vicki Lawrence, thank you. Thank you for doing this, I think it's super important. I imagine when we get to the tier two and tier threes, that's when you get really involved with parents as well. help equip them with the right tools and resources to help their child navigate. But at tier one, how can we as parents support our children better so that they're not going into tier two and tier three? We can help that. So what kind of tools and how are you scaling that to parents at that level, at that base level?
You can,
if
you want to start?
Sure.
And I'll.
Hi, thank you. That's a great question because back to the part of where it takes a village, it really is, you want that prevalence at every tier. It's not like, oh, we're going to call the parents now that it's tier three. That's not the approach. It's really we want everyone involved, so I'm glad that you brought that up. I am new to Willard, so I am still into District 90, so I am still learning that and getting to know parents and that those systems in place. So I'll speak a little bit to my experience here so far, but then also just my knowledge in general. So far at Willard, I have noticed that there's a lot of proactive communication with parents, that tomorrow and Thursday will not be the first time that parents are hearing about how their student is doing, whether it's academically or socially. Sometimes I hear, whether it's in the hallway or in a specific conversation about, from teachers that they want to be able to communicate these things to parents even more. That, a parent mentioned to me last week that for 5 weeks their child's been feeling this way. I had lost sleep last night thinking about it. I can't believe that, the student was feeling this way and I didn't know. So sometimes I think there's a disconnect where everybody wants to be doing more at that tier one level. Obviously, parent-teacher conferences are a way of doing that, and I think that every classroom teacher has a different form of communicating with their parents. So that's sort of speaking to that piece. I think that that can be customized and varies. But in terms of like a building level, I think that some of the things like the Willard Way or the Lincoln Pride and that language, kind of with any sort of intervention with a student, that consistent messaging is so important because, a little first grader hears so many words throughout their day, so many instructions from so many people, maybe a stranger they've never seen in the hall before, a teacher that, works upstairs that they pass for the first time during the Halloween parade is telling them to get in line. So there's all sorts of interactions that they're hearing. So that when the more that messaging is consistent, the same words are used. So whether that's at home, whether that's in a club while at school, whether that's at recess, that's at the playground, that's in the lunchroom, it's in the classroom, that is really where all of a sudden that messaging means more because it's gonna hit them in a place that, oh, I know this, I've been primed for this. So I think that joining at that level is also a tier one intervention. And then I'm gonna pass off to Ms. Nichols.
I just wanna say I think the biggest thing that you could do as parents is really model the kind of managing of behavior, managing of your emotions, treating others with respect, and building respectful, trusting relationships, I think is the biggest thing that you can do, and there's so many ways that you can do that. And I would say that myself and all my colleagues, we're really open to talking to parents if you have any concerns, no matter big, small, to reach out for us for more specifics. But I think it's really, children really pay attention to us in terms of what we're doing and how we're presenting ourselves. So I think it's really working on trust and respectful, trusting and respectful relationships.
I think that's helpful, but as I have an 11-year-old, and she's in fifth grade, and so I'm navigating all of the social media things and grades for the first time, and there's a lot of firsts, even as a parent, even if I'm a good model with my relationships, navigating how she handles TikTok or other things is new for me. And I think she comes home, she'll share things that her friends are doing or what have you. How are you guys handling some of the social media challenges that come up? And with kids being able to bring home their iPads and them having access to things maybe that we wouldn't normally have allow them to have access to at home. Certainly we can do our best to monitor that behavior, but we can't be on it all the time. So what are some of the things that you're doing at school to help navigate that?
I don't have a real easy answer for that one, and since I'm at the elementary school, I'm thankful I don't have to deal with some of these, but these issues. But I think that You know, we had a wonderful speaker. We've had a couple of speakers come to talk about technology and the use of it. I mean, last year I know that there was someone who came to speak on terms of that. And I think you have to, every household is different. I would really encourage not a whole lot of use that's not needed for educational purposes, but that's my personal belief. And I don't know, you know, is Kevin?
I'm so glad you're here.
Yeah, it is very different. I'm tech director, so I can chime in. I mean, from a very basic standpoint, there's a filtering system on a student iPad. So the reality in this community is that there are probably additional devices in the home that aren't subject to those same restrictions. What we really stress is that the iPad that the district issues is a tool. It's really supposed to be used exclusively for schoolwork, exclusively for homework. The new restrictions are that they're not going to aimlessly wander on YouTube and be able to look at whatever they want for hours on end. Every video has got to be approved by a teacher, or it's got to meet a certain threshold that YouTube has said, okay, this is appropriate for middle schoolers.
Is that only within, when it's within this Wi-Fi, that they go into it?
No, everywhere. It's filtered everywhere.
It's different information that I've got.
Yeah, ever since the iPads at Roosevelt have been going home, there's been that. No, that's not true. The last 3 years, the security filter has been in place when the iPads are at home. We are also using the same security filter when they're in school, so that we get better reporting about what they're doing during school time, as well as what they're doing when they're at home. Some basic things that we say is, you know, any use of negatives, it's individual to each home, but we say, you know, again, along the lines of modeling, is there's no need for that iPad to be in a bedroom with a kid on their own. It should be used in a public place. It should be taken away in the evening and charged in the kitchen or in the dining room. It doesn't need to go under the pillow. It doesn't need to be in the bedroom. And there's never a situation where a kid should be on it for 3, 4, or 5 hours at home. They're going to have some homework that's going to require the use of it, but then you should feel free to take it away and say, you know what? You're done with your homework, you're not using that anymore. What we often hear is that that gets taken away, and then they're like, Mom, Dad, can I borrow your phone? Can I listen on the computer? Can I use the family iPad? That's, you know, kind of back on you and what kind of modeling you set at home. But in terms of that school one, you should absolutely feel confident taking it away and not letting it go into a room. Have them do their homework at the dining room table. And then when they're done, thank you very much. We'll be charging that in the kitchen. We'll be ready for you in the morning.
Kevin, from an emotional kind of wellness perspective, can you speak just a moment also about the digital citizenship curriculum that's taught?
Yeah, so we had a lot of focus on it the last couple of years, where we really want the kids to be aware of it and hear it from everywhere within their curricular areas. So we don't want it to be an isolated go to a room and hear about how to be a digital citizenship. But everything about, you know, starting with fifth graders, and the cameras were turned off on their iPads for the first couple of weeks until there was that lesson about why do you take photos? What is an appropriate photo to take? What do you do with that photo? What kind of permissions do you need to get from the person who you took a photo of? Then what do you do with that photo? And where do you post it? So we really try to very carefully walk them through those situations and those learning opportunities of, okay, it's not as simple as you're going to have a site, a website, when you're doing a research paper, but what are you going to say about yourself when you're in social media situations? What are you capable, what should you or should you not be saying about your peers in those situations? So we really focus on making those important lessons all through their curriculum.
And those lessons take place on the elementary school level, too.
I would just add that middle school in particular is... the power of the peer group is what guides a lot of their decision making. And what's hard about that is they will make decisions with their peer group that they would never make by themselves or with you. So it's really tough to set boundaries at this age. And the happiest kids we see are the ones that don't engage in social media, but there's social pressures around that too. So how do you balance the pressure of wanting to see what other kids are doing, but then also staying out of the fray? And I think that's a real challenge. I wish I had an answer for that.
That was perfect. I just wanted to hear what you guys were doing in school. Trust me, I didn't know how to take that. I have a lot of confidence in that area.
I also just want
that I'm glad that you mentioned this. You mentioned a lot of firsts that you're experiencing, and I think that how a lot of tier one interventions come about, yes, it's a lot of research and trends, and that's important too, but it also comes from the community. Tier supports are student need driven, which is community driven, parent driven. So when you describe feeling a lot of firsts, you're not alone in that. There's a lot of parents that might be experiencing that same thing, or a lot of things that your daughter's experiencing, other students are feeling. So when things are voiced and communicated, all of a sudden this becomes a need and something can be developed or integrated that would support those needs. So please continue to do that. Thank you.
We went to a IASB dinner the other night, and it was a policeman there. The subject was cyberbullying. And the policeman made a good point in saying that when your child turns 16, you don't just give them the car and say, go do whatever. Like a set of rules, there's a routine set up to promote safety and things like that. So the officer said, with the expense of phones now, parents should make a practice of doing that, giving your child a phone to keep them from either being a bully or get involved in bullying. I think that's something as parents we kind of need to set some guidelines once the phone is at, instead of just saying, it's your birthday, open it up, go run with it. Because we wouldn't do that with the car. So that's kind of a new thing that they're coming up with now.
Okay, actually, just I'll tag off that before I ask my question, which is the district had a great speaker about 5 or 6 years ago who did a thing about cell phone contracts. I don't remember her name, but she was great. I did a cell phone contract with my kids, and it's been, I mean, I'll give myself a win because I think they kind of respect it. All right, but here's my question. I actually have two questions. So the first is I'm just curious what the criteria are or how the different SEL programs and curriculum that are being used, how those are selected and how often it's revisited. For example, like Second Step, why was that particular program chosen? And then secondarily, on a more global level, what, if anything, is the district trying to do to tackle the hard thing of evaluating how successful these different strategies are? So two questions there.
Second Step predates me, so I'm not sure.
It doesn't predate me. Second Step, I can do it. Can you guys hear me if I don't use the microphone? I so don't.
The camera.
Better to be mic.
The camera can.
Better be mic.
We need it for the.
Unfortunately. Okay. Second Step was chosen after a lot of research. And it was chosen because it is evidence-based. And there's a lot of research that's been put in internationally on the value of Second Step when it is delivered with consistency and fidelity. And there is evaluation components with it. We have, as a district, done some. It is really hard to assess a social emotional growth. I mean, to start with a really solid starting point and where you're going to. And so because these are more soft kind of skills too, but we use the Devereaux assessment, which is connected with Second Step initially when we started it. And I think that just we ongoingly think about what's working and what's not working. And
I don't know if anybody wants to add anything to that.
As I said, most of this predates me, but I do think your question about measurement is an important one, and I do think I echo what Suzanne says, and how do you assess some of these things? How do you quantify something that is really difficult to quantify?
We've even had a hard time just finding a really good, solid, accurate screener for social emotional needs and skills. So it's something that's an area that there still needs to be more research.
It's definitely an area for growth, I think.
The one thing about kids is that they're brutally honest. And so we find, truthfully, that if we ask them about their experience, they will share that. And so, as I think you're aware from some of your volunteering and some other folks in the room, we just finished the administration of the third Inclusiveness Advisory Board survey, which was administered, of course, to parents, staff, and students. But really, the aspiration of that survey is to get at its very heart, the degree to which children and staff and families, but predominantly children, feel as though they belong. Honestly, that's our strongest aspiration when it comes to social, emotional wellness and goals, would be that everyone in our school community, but particularly children, feel belongingness here, because that's really what would reflect most likely a student becoming self-actualized. If they have that, they can then move up the progression that Dr. Holly spoke about earlier. So we do follow that survey, and just for the community's knowledge, it was actually administered in April, but we've been doing some data disaggregation over the summer and then into the fall. The data was just posted, I think, last week on the District 90 website. And in addition to looking at that survey is administered with both quantitative and qualitative data, certainly the quantitative data is very helpful in terms of understanding the degree of feeling to which kids indicate that they belong. But the qualitative data couples very well with it because it really speaks to kind of the richness of the kids' individual experiences. And the Inclusiveness Advisory Board actually has a subgroup right now that just completed doing some review of the qualitative data to identify the themes that have come out from that. And, the kind of from a big picture perspective, I would say that in broad strokes, the feeling from that group was qualitatively, the kids had indicated that the district does a pretty good job, and of course I'm taking 600 plus responses here, distilling it into three sentences. But the district does a pretty good job of outlining what we're hoping for kids and providing programs and policies and making this a safe place. Where we can definitely show areas for improvement are a subsection of children who indicate that they have had a specific experience where either they have been bullied, a child they know has been bullied, and importantly, that they have felt as though it either wasn't handled fairly or thoroughly. And it does represent, fortunately, a subset of children. This is not the general sentiment. But even knowing that there's a portion of kids out there where if the goal is belonging, they don't feel they belong, and importantly, the district can certainly do a better job meeting their specific need, that's a pretty high call. I know I've kind of gone around my elbow to get back to my wrist on this, but the point was, genuinely, to ask children how they feel, let them share their experience in a way that's safe for them, and then honor that by accepting it, and frankly, putting forth plans to do something about it, I think is really important. And so we're looking forward to using that data after the upcoming IEB meeting to incorporate it as hopefully some of the themes that we're going to talk about in planning for the forthcoming strategic plan.
Thank you.
For second step at both the middles, I'm sorry, it's used both at the elementary school and middle school, right? Is that the?
I don't think second step, but only was used in fifth grade, but I think the advice. This is my understanding, and so my understanding may not be accurate, but I think second step goes from pre-K to fourth grade in the district, and it was used in fifth grade. But I do not think finding the time to have it delivered and used regularly as curriculum was tricky. So I think it's really the advisory that is taking the place of second step at the middle school.
That's correct.
Thanks.
And is there a specific curriculum that's used in advisory?
I'm sorry?
Is there a specific curriculum?
Yes, there is a curriculum that got developed, that has been developed. For the advisory, and teachers are given some, help in delivering it. Again, it's going to be the person who's delivering it and how effective it's going to be in terms of, but that's true for any single curriculum, whether it's math or writing or anything else. So that is the focus there. And I know that it's constantly being looked at if it's being successful or not and how it can be made better.
And if I could just add that one of the needs of the district was to help is to have a social worker, an extra social worker, work with teachers. to develop the curriculum.
Absolutely.
And the advisory and the CIP,
right.
that was up here too. So, and through continuous evaluation and feedback, we learned that we needed to increase our support, and we did that.
And just as a follow-up, at the elementary school level, what's the frequency with which they do the second step programming? Is it a
weekly?
It's a weekly. And it's just done with the regular teacher.
Mm-hmm. And when it, we...
Good job.
When we piloted it, I went in, we piloted it in a specific grade, and I delivered it, and then we stretched it out to every grade. That's how it worked. But I was there to help in terms of the delivery until teachers became comfortable with it. But we've had Second Step for a while now, so it's really an embedded part, and children can tell you, should be able to tell you about it at both elementary schools.
For clarity, the curriculum for the Roosevelt Advisory Program is developed in-house here in D90 using outside resources. It's not a prepackaged.
The advisory, really quick. So, like, when they're learning in eighth grade, advisory obviously is different than fifth grade. You know, having two older kids and two now in fifth grade, I have one very anxious little girl. And I think part of her anxiousness is the grades. I've never seen it with my three boys, but my daughter is very anxious, doesn't want to go to school, cries, you know, so it's hard. But Ms. Lenardini was great with her and has been. But I don't know if you've seen an uptick in fifth grade anxiousness in kids coming to school. I don't know if you have. If it's just a change, I understand, but I'd be curious to see if there's been a just an uptick in fifth grade anxiety, or if I'm just seeing it with one of my three, four, you know, kids.
We don't have a middle school social worker with us here tonight, so it'd be hard to speak to that with authenticity. But
I just want to say, in my work in the district, I think there every year there's been an increase in anxiety.
Since
I've been here, there has been an increase in anxiety. I'm not sure of all the reasons why, but there is a lot more anxiety. And I think if you went to the high school, that would be the case also. And that's something all of us have to take a look at and figure out what we can do about that. I think some children are more sensitive to feelings of anxiety than others, and really the whole point of social emotional learning is to really help children be resilient so that they can cope and they have some ways. You know, there's nothing, being an anxious person can keep you really growing. It's a question of you finding a way to accept yourself and to feel comfortable with that anxiety and to use it for you as opposed to being an obstacle.
To build on that, are you seeing, like you said, you're seeing an uptick in elementary school? Is there a certain grade, or certain, like, I mean, a lot of these kids, some people are just anxious people, I know.
Yeah.
I am, but do you notice, like, is it when they become, you know, close to fourth grade, or are you really noticing it at all levels in elementary school? Anxiety, like, what do you think?
I think at all levels. I think it used to be that I could tell when there were jumps, like between second grade and third grade,
okay.
Because the shift is from learning how to read to learning and reading to learn. But I wouldn't, and you would think there would be one from fourth grade to fifth grade. But I don't think I could, in my mind, honestly say in my clinical experience right now that I can so easily point to those points.
I mean, every child is different, right?
Yeah. I'd say it's all grade levels. I do think that in third grade, there tends to be higher expectations all around.
Right.
And so I would say that, generally speaking, that can be a grade where, you know, there's more independence, there's generally more asked of students, so it can become more anxiety-provoking. And maybe things that worked previously for them to cope with it or ignore it are harder at that point. But I do think it's all grades, so there's an increase in general.
I know, just from my personal experience with having three going through, well, one just starting at Roosevelt, but two of my three, I could see the anxiety rise significantly going into fifth grade. So I really, And actually, I think Roosevelt did a wonderful job, especially with one. I mean, took my child to the tier three and successfully, and it was really helpful. And I'm really happy. You know, I have nothing but like positive things to say about how Roosevelt handled it. But I think, you know, 10 years old is tough to make that transition. Eighth graders are, you know, my daughter mentions all the time how she can't believe she goes to school with these eighth graders that look like adults. But anyway, I do have one question about trauma-induced care. I mean, I know that you have to have really specific skills, and I'm just wondering, like, for ongoing education, like, where are you guys getting it from? How is that? How are you getting these in-services? Just being a pediatric nurse and having to deal with a lot of that in my work, I'm just curious for myself, like, where you're getting that education and how is that continuing on?
So that's actually an area for growth for us. We know that that's coming on the horizon, the trauma-informed care, and having a better understanding of that. So we do not have a systemic response to that at this time, but it's something we know we need to be wading into. And in addition to our social workers who've indicated that that's the direction this is going, our director of special education also is bringing some expertise to that. So more to come.
Great, thanks.
Jenny, my experience raising five kids who went through here is that the fifth grade transition is a challenging one. And it is unique to D90 that we do that in fifth grade, as opposed to making that jump in sixth. And it is a little bit sticky, I think, for all of them. And I think that maybe has gotten more difficult with the rise of social media and the prevalence of all of those outside influences. And I know how difficult it is to limit them. I was very fortunate, and I was kind of at the tail end of when you could really tell your kids that they couldn't have a cell phone until they got into high school. We were the most detested parents in River Forest. We did do it. We didn't like it, but we did. To the extent that it's possible to limit their involvement with social media and to talk to them about what that means and how seriously to take it. You know, those are things that all parents can do. They're never easy conversations to have. And there are a lot of wonderful books written on the impact of social media on kids. And, you know, there's a lot of good thought, and I think there's beginning to be more study of the specifics involved with that. But you know, my children are farther along, and I can tell you that middle school was tough for everybody. All of us remember that, and all will be well, and we'll support them as best we can.
I had a comment and a question, and thank you all for contributing to this discussion. It's been really interesting. Dr. Conlon, there. Comment about the survey results in trying to assess how students felt in terms of belonging. And I understand that it's really difficult to sort of measure the outcomes of this. Actually, the outcomes you probably, you know, our children end up moving on and going to college and high school and doing well, and that would be a wonderful outcome. But question or concern, it's not more in terms of the effectiveness of these words, but maybe how to identify those children who are sort of not doing well or not feeling a sense of belongingness and some trouble. But as a mom who has a new middle schooler, my son was always quiet to begin with, but he's even more quiet now, I think, and shares less with me. And I'm concerned that maybe an advisory or the other systems that we have in place, you know, what other options do children have to if they are in trouble? And how can we, as parents and teachers and administrators and people in the community, strive to help identify children who are in need? I'm sure you've all heard the rates of suicidal is still extremely rare. In the younger groups of adults and children have alarmingly risen in the last few years. And I just am more worried about that. They're obviously studying and trying to understand why that is. But I guess relating to this discussion, I just wanted to know what there was certainly as well to sort of identify children who don't have this sense of belonging or are at risk for depression.
Well, we're at just a slight bit of a loss because we don't have a Roosevelt social worker with us here tonight. They are, I'll brag on them in their absence, they are tremendous, and their relationships with classroom teachers, I think, are a part of the answer to your question. There is a pretty good, I won't say that it happens certainly in every case, I'm sure it does not, unfortunately, but there is a pretty good sense, I think, that experienced teachers have if there is a student in their charge that seems disconnected from the rest of the kids in the class. I know that social workers have relationships with teachers, and the expectation that information will flow back and forth is pretty standard. The shame of it is that there are occasions where that's missed. You know, the Roosevelt Advisory Program is an interesting example because there are students where participating in advisory makes them very uncomfortable. We believe as adults that it's a great, you know, program because it helps to build relationships between kids, relationships between kids and adults. There's a lot of research that indicates that for kids to have that smaller peer group, that's one of the bases for why we established that in the first place, of kids where they know that they have at least one or two close connections can be the difference in a child feeling that sense of belonging at school. But there are also students where having to be in a situation like that, and particularly if they're asked to share their feelings, can be really, a difficult scenario for them. So that's the danger. I guess I'm kind of, as much as anything, I'm certainly not answering the specifics of your question, undoubtedly as well as you'd like, but agreeing with you that we do, I think, in organizations, I think generally, schools probably, as a group, pretty well at applying solutions that address the needs of most kids. It's when you have children that fall outside that range of what is considered to be typical, whether in terms of how they respond to a situation or what their needs are, that's where I think the real call is. We have increased the number of social workers in middle school. It was just a couple of years ago we hired our third full-time social worker here. And she was a great asset because she brought the Roosevelt Advisory Program concept with her and has been the one who's been really spearheading that. I will tell you that even though that survey data that I spoke to earlier didn't identify the children, of course, who responded, and actually that's probably one of the reasons we got such honest feedback, because it was both anonymous and confidential. I will tell you that the data that the teachers reviewed that showed even just that small percentage of kids who answered, I don't have an adult in the school that I have a relationship with, that I have a trusting relationship with, the power of that to a group of adults who are in this business because they love kids and they want kids to be successful and they want kids to have a place, in and of itself is extraordinary. I mean, as was mentioned before, that was one of the main motivations for our faculty to gather around and support the advent of the Roosevelt Advisory Program. So we don't have, by any means, magic bullet on that. I do think the relationships that we have in our school are generally close, and that's helpful. But we have concern about that small number of kids. I sit on the regional suicide task force in West Cook, and that, as well as some other linkages we have with some of these excellent outside agencies, have been helpful. I know our Roosevelt social workers and elementary social workers are quick to bring in partners from the community if we identify children. We do count on parents to let us know if they're seeing things at home or hearing things at home that we're not aware of. Occasionally, children will act differently at home than they do at school. I know that certainly happened in my house. And so, you know, we do count on parents to also communicate with us. But
I could just
yes, that's a great, Barb just mentioned the support for your program. Yeah, and that was a recent addition, thanks to several community partners a couple years ago, which is an anonymous texting program where kids can text in to a licensed clinical social worker. The goal of that program is that the social worker will establish a texting, you know, communication with them and to try to steer the child towards school or community resources, depending upon what the child finds the social finds to be interesting for them or what they're willing to do. In a serious situation, if in that texting correspondence, the like really serious situation, the licensed clinical social worker does have the ability to alert emergency services, and they will go around that commitment. Obviously, we make to kids that it be anonymous and confidential and contact the police. And the police do have the ability to, through the use of the phone IP address, to identify who the sender is. It's a son of a child who's got suicidal ideation or something like that. So I'm really glad that both mentioned that. This is the second year that that's in place. And it's not District 90, 97, and the high school as well.
Just one thing I'd like to add as well is the grade level teams at Roosevelt meet weekly. And part of the function of that meeting is if they have concerns about individual students, they will bring it up at that meeting. Basically say, I'm noticing this. Do you also notice this? What is this child like with you versus with me? And so it's an opportunity for them to take a closer look when somebody brings forth a concern about a child. So that's a vehicle where that that can also service if need be. They meet weekly. They're pretty committed to doing that.
I also think on Wednesdays, the advisory eats lunch together, I believe at Roosevelt, which I didn't know until a couple years ago. So I think that's a great thing that the fifth grade, they have to eat with their advisory. And I think Larry's discussed it where he says sometimes that kid who's sitting next to might be the only day those two kids talk, but on Wednesday, those children are looking forward to having different friendships at the table. So I think it's a great thing. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. I think, well, I know that the board members up here have at least 18 children who have gone through District 90 and have experienced probably every one of your questions in various forms, and they are our concerns. And so we've talked about a system of supports, but ultimately it comes down to your individual child and our individual children. So. We thank District 90 administration and support staff for coming out tonight and filling us in on what's going on in District 90.
Maybe we could just thank our social workers and Dr. Holland.
Okay, thank you all. We have one order of business, I believe. Can I have a motion to approve the personnel report that was in your board packet?
Who made the motion?
I heard Barb.
I did.
Second to Barb, okay. Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Can I get a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.